You're listening to Building a Just World, Fair Trade, Ethical Trade, and Canada.
The real key here is that the farmers themselves are empowered by their participation in the fair trade system.
This three-part documentary series explores growing international movements to create new trading systems that respect farmers and workers, and to establish ethical standards in manufacturing and resource extraction.
Fair trade has made possible for indigenous people to connect to other communities beyond these boundaries.
I'm Kristen Schwartz.
And I'm Asad Ismi.
This is the third part of our series. For the next half hour, we'll be discussing the movement for sweatshop-free clothing manufacturing, which is gathering steam in cities across Canada. And we'll look at the campaigns for ethical and environmental standards in the mining industry, one of the most destructive in the world today. Stay tuned.
The apparel and textile industries are the largest industrial employer in the world. The apparel sector represents about half of that global industry. Almost 24 million workers are employed in the garment industry worldwide. Close to 75% are women. The major focus of ethical trade is on the garment manufacturing sector, which is marked by sweatshop factories, mainly located in Bangladesh, Indonesia, Burma, China, Vietnam, Mexico, and Central America. In these areas, wages are lowest and union organizing is repressed. This exploitation is enforced by the policies of northern multinational retailers and super labels, such as Walmart, Nike, and Hudson's Bay, that are the main customers of the factories. A large percentage of clothes in Canada are made in sweatshops.
Labor rights violations in the sweatshops include mandatory pregnancy testing, child labor, indentured labor, denial of access to health care, high production quotas, body searches, and verbal abuse. The three most important violations are the low wages, compulsory unpaid overtime, and denial of union representation. Workers are toiling long hours for little pay and are fired if they attempt to organize a union to change this situation. Most Canadian retailers are 10 years behind their U.S. counterparts in how they deal with these issues. As author David Ransom puts it, "So now, in the postmodern age, our largest and most useful industry, supplying a necessity little less basic than food, has headed off back to the dark, satanic mills of the 19th century."
Claudia Quintanilla is a graduate student at the University of Calgary, studying women maquila workers in El Salvador, where the wage is about $5 a day. She recently went there to interview them.
I went to the supermarkets there, and I spent like about $100 in like my own shopping in like for a week. And these people are making $160 a month. A pound of meat is $4. I think it's like about 2.5 pounds of beans for like $1.99, something like that. I don't think they eat enough or in an appropriate way. I really don't know what they eat.
Working conditions in the maquilas are atrocious.
If the women show 5 minutes late to the factories or to the sweatshops or to the maquilas, they're not allowed to come in, a lot of them. So they have to go back home and they have lost their fare, their transportation money, and they lost that day. The majority are single women. And sometimes these women are forced to work extra hours. Then it's called voluntary work, but it's not really voluntary work because if they don't stay, they will be the first ones to don't have jobs in the times then they suspend a lot of workers because they don't have enough work. Women live under strict rules inside the maquilas. It's not allowed to talk. Women in the maquilas have to be silent. If they lose 5 minutes to go to the bathroom, they're losing type of production and they're not going to be able to achieve la meta, what is the number of pieces that have to be sold that day. So a lot of them, they're even afraid to look to another person or to look to the side because they're going to lose a precious second.
Maquila work can sometimes be fatal.
This one was one of the worst interviews I have, and was with this lady who have a daughter who died inside a maquila because the daughter have like a terrible stomachache when she was inside the place. She asked for permit to leave, and she was said by her supervisor that she cannot leave until her shift is over at 7 in the morning. By 7 in the morning, she had passed out because she had appendicitis that turned to be peritonitis, and she died. She was 22, 23. She had a little baby, 2 months old. And until now, no 1 cent had been given to the grandmother who was taking care of this child. And no any charge had been made in the supervisor who didn't allow her to go home. A lot of people are dying due to emphysema in the lungs. I interviewed one woman who is a supervisor in the Maquilas. Her father is dying of lung cancer because he had lung emphysema. He had pieces of material inside his lungs. Another example is a woman who was pregnant, was working in a Maquila. They took her to the hospital when she had the baby, and the baby had to be kept like in a respirator for a few months because he had problems with his lungs, the baby.
Such blatant exploitation and dangerous working conditions have given rise to an international movement aimed at the eradication of sweatshops in the garment industry. The Toronto-based Maquila Solidarity Network promotes solidarity with groups in Mexico, Central America, and Asia, organizing in maquiladora factories and export processing zones to improve conditions and win a living wage. According to the Maquila Solidarity Network, in a global economy, it is essential that groups in the North and South work together for employment with dignity, fair wages and working conditions, and healthy workplaces and communities.
The Maquila Solidarity Network is part of the Ethical Trading Action Group, which includes the Canadian Labour Congress and the Union of Needle Trades, Industrial and Textile Employees, Unite. Kevin Thomas is with the Maquila Solidarity Network. He explains how northern retailers, like Walmart, drive down the wages of third world workers.
The actual labor costs in a piece of apparel is usually maybe 1 to 3% of the actual cost that we pay. The rest of that goes into things like transport and distribution and marketing primarily, rather than actually paying the workers. So if you look at that, it makes it really clear that you could double or triple the wages of workers in apparel factories and have almost no impact on the actual price of the goods in the store. Where it's really least profitable is for the factories involved. You'll see as you go up the supply chain, up to the retail brands, the brands tend to make the most. The retail, sort of no-name retail operations make less. And then, of course, the factories that actually produce the goods have very tight profit margins. They don't tend to make as much because they're getting squeezed all the time by the northern retail companies. And at the bottom of the equation, of course, as always, are the workers who actually produce the goods and manufacture this stuff. They're making nothing, not even a living wage.
Walmart is the biggest company in the apparel sector in the world.
If a company producing any particular good, whether it's apparel or garbage cans or microwave ovens or whatever, if they want to sell in the North American markets, the real prize is a contract with Walmart so that they can actually put their goods on the shelves in Walmart stores. If they get that, that's great for them. Their business goes up overnight because they have such a huge distribution network. But at the same time, Walmart then uses that as an opportunity to squeeze that manufacturer every year to lower their price. And, of course, to lower their price means they have to find cost savings somewhere. And, as always, the people who bear those cost savings are the workers. They find a way to cut standards. They find a way to cut wages. They certainly find a way to cut back on anything which might drive up the price, such as union drives. And that is why Walmart, of course, is so incredibly notorious for its attacks on unions.
Workers in garment factories in the South are fired when they try to unionize. One way activists in the North help their struggle is by pressuring large public institutions that buy a lot of clothing.
We have found that institutions, large public institutions, have a lot more say. Universities, municipalities, provincial governments, federal government for that matter, all buy quite large amounts of apparel in 1 year. And so we thought, well, if they could say, we will only buy from your company if you respect these minimum labor rights, then they'd have much more chance of being listened to. And the fact is that's actually been working. So we've been passing these policies across the country and using these policies to support efforts. When workers are trying to organize, we put the pressure on from the other side to say, okay, respect their right, do not fire these people, reinstate people if you have fired them, recognize the union, etc.
13 Canadian universities and close to 200 in the United States have adopted codes of conduct aimed at ensuring that their clothing does not come from sweatshops. Now city governments are considering similar policies. Vancouver has already adopted one, as has Toronto.
One of the most recent being the City of Toronto, who have passed a code for their own apparel purchases. And they buy about $4 million a year worth of clothing, and so therefore they've got a real say on what happens in those factories. Now, since that was passed, Ottawa City Council is looking to pass one, and Halifax and Calgary are also developing them.
Paulette Sadoway is the Nova Scotia Regional Representative with the Canadian Labour Congress. She's been campaigning for all municipalities in the province to adopt anti-sweatshop procurement policies.
There are a number of conditions, I guess, that could be applied that means something is no sweat. First of all, it needs to be made in a place where the workers in the factory have a say in their working conditions. So in a country, for example, where unions are not legal or collective bargaining is not possible, we would consider that to be a sweatshop. And there is no child labor used in producing the items. Workers have a living wage and are able to afford the things that they're making. And that things like screening for pregnancy is not used.
But the codes are not enough as long as corporations that encourage sweatshops dominate the clothing market.
We've got to find a way to move beyond just those university and municipal codes and try to find ways to pressure some of the largest companies in the market, like Walmart, because as long as they drive the market in the opposite direction, to lower labor standards, to lower wages, etc., then there's a huge pressure from that side, which we've got to learn how to tackle. We can't just sort of create a niche area where things are getting better and leave the rest of the market to people, the likes of Walmart.
A change in public attitude is required that goes beyond consumerism.
The real value of this is solidarity, and that is finding methods and tactics which actually allow us to express solidarity with workers around the world so that it's not just about consuming with a clean conscience or something like that. It's about actually seeing those workers' struggles as our own and therefore finding what our connection is to them and how we can exert influence to support them. That's the bottom line.
And we have to demand to know in which conditions the goods that we're consuming are being made. We should demand from the companies that are selling things to us to know how much the worker was making. Is this worker get maternity leave? How many pieces this worker make a day? How much money your company make? So then the clothes that we wear is going to have a real meaning. It just isn't going to mean it's making me look more pretty, it's making me look more cool, it's making me look more on fashion. It's going to have a real meaning, a meaning that is telling us how this clothes was made, who died for this clothes.
Y en esa orilla del mundo no duerme la maquiladora de un desperdicio en la tierra. El hijo del sol nació.
You are listening to Building a Just World, Fair Trade, Ethical Trade, and Canada, a documentary series. We were discussing ethical trade in apparel. Stay tuned for the second half of this program, where we look at efforts to apply ethical standards to the mining industry.
Most minerals needed for industries in northern countries come from the third world, especially Africa. Nearly 80% of the strategic minerals the United States requires are found in Africa, including 90% of the world's cobalt, 90% of the platinum, 40% of the gold, 98% of the chromium, 64% of the manganese, and one-third of the uranium. These minerals are needed to make jet engines, cars, missiles, electronic components, iron and steel. No industrial society can exist without these substances. Yet, as with coffee and cocoa, the world prices of such crucial raw materials remain very low, and third world countries benefit little from them. Miners are low paid all over the developing world and often work under horrendous conditions.
The Congo is the richest country in Africa in terms of mining wealth and has been torn apart by a 6-year-long war which has killed more than 4 million people. Destructive civil wars in Angola and Sierra Leone have been financed by diamond sales. The U.S. government and mining companies have been behind the wars in all three countries, one effect of which has been to keep the price of minerals low. Thabo Madilaba spoke in the first episode of this series as National Director of the Environmental Justice Networking Forum based in South Africa. The forum is part of the Africa Initiative on Mining, Environment and Society, AIMS, which is a pan-African network. He explains how the operations of Western mining companies in Africa increase poverty on the continent.
In most instances, these companies do not actually pay for the raw materials. The countries even go to a point where they give concessions where companies don't even have to pay royalties, even as much as 10 years. There is nothing that is being put into Africa. The little that the West is putting in is basically the minimum that is needed for their operations to take place. They pay very little to the workers because the workers have to eat and they have to be able to come to work. And they have to pay some little so that there are some few roads that they can use to transport the raw material. So when you do some cost-benefit analysis, when you subtract all the money that the companies are supposed to be bringing to the country against the money that the country is losing in terms of taxes, in terms of expenditures on public health, in terms of ecological debt, that actually leaves you with a huge negative. So instead of paying even very little, they are actually leaving the continent with a negative balance, which means that the continent becomes even much and much poorer by day.
Ghana is Africa's second largest producer of gold, yet benefits little from its export, since the mines are mostly owned by Western multinational companies that pay no income tax or duties and can repatriate 95% of their profits into foreign accounts. There have been massive layoffs of gold mine workers, and mining has displaced 30,000 people in Ghana, contaminated rivers and streams, and destroyed farm and forest lands. So not only are mineral prices low and miners paid very little, third world communities are displaced and their livelihoods ruined by Western mining companies.
Many foreign mining companies in Ghana are Canadian. The operation of the Tarkwa gold mine, which is partly owned by the Canadian company IM Gold, has led to significant human rights violations and enormous environmental destruction. In December 1999, police shot and wounded 9 people during demonstrations against the layoff of 1,000 workers at the mine. The Tarkwa mine has caused the forcible removal of 20,000 people from their homes, as well as Ghana's worst environmental disaster. In October 2001, a dam holding toxic wastewater at the mine burst, sending thousands of cubic meters of cyanide into the Assiniboine River. Virtually all life forms at the river were killed, and 1,000 people lost access to drinking water.
Canada is the world's leading nation in the area of mineral exploration. 2/3 of global mining capital is raised on Canadian stock exchanges. 85% of all mining deals are made in Canada. 60% of mining multinationals in the world are Canadian, and they benefit from significant tax breaks. There are more than 170 Canadian mining companies in Africa alone, with 530 properties. As with their impact on Ghana, Canadian mining companies have become notorious for environmental destruction and human rights violations all over the world, to such an extent that they are known as the Ugly Canadians.
In the South American country of Guyana, the mining operations of the Canadian companies Cambior and Golden Star caused reportedly the biggest cyanide spill in world history. In August 1995, the dam containing toxic mining waste at the Omai mine burst, sending 4 billion liters of cyanide-filled mud into the Essequibo River, Guyana's main river and its most important source of fresh water. The government declared a national emergency. In the province of Marinduque in the Philippines, Placer Dome, one of Canada's biggest mining companies, is responsible for 30 years of environmental destruction. This has turned parts of the province into a toxic wasteland. In 1996, the dumping of waste from a Placer Dome mine killed two rivers that provided the livelihood of 12 fishing villages. The company is being sued in the United States by the Marinduque provincial government.
Also in the Philippines, the operations of another Canadian mining company, Toronto Ventures International, TVI, have generated considerable conflict with the Subanon indigenous people, who live on Kanathuan Mountain and in the nearby towns of Shokon and Zamboanga on the island of Mindanao. TVI's mining operations here threaten to destroy the Subanon's way of life, which emphasizes harmony with nature. TVI has already bulldozed the tip of Mount Kanathuan. Timoy Nabalambo is one of the leaders of the Subanon.
The original people in Kanathuan do not accept the mining, because the mining will cause the total destruction of the area, which has been declared by our ancestors. That area is considered as a holy place for this one. Kanathuan, to the Subanon people, is very valuable. We cannot afford the mountains of Kanathuan will be destroyed. If this mining will continue, that will cause a lot of destruction in our environments. There will be a total dislocation of our tribe living in the area.
Displacement.
Yes. Displacement. Yes. And where will our tribe go? We have nowhere to go.
Community opposition to the TVI mine has been met by violence from the company's paramilitary force known as the Special Civilian Armed Auxiliaries, SCAA. The SCAA is trained and armed by the Philippine military, but employed by TVI. In March 2004, the SCAA fired on demonstrators protesting the movement of mining equipment. Four people, including the tribal elder Timoy Macario Salakau, were hit and wounded.
TVI has also tried to divide the Subanon by setting up a fake leadership group the same day that Timoy Nubalambo publicly opposed the validation of this group. His daughter was kidnapped.
On that very day, my daughter in Samanga was kidnapped. Yes, my daughter was kidnapped. The purpose of kidnapping my daughter is for me to stop declaring, pronouncing the validation. You see how my life is being Absolutely. Affected about this, what the TVA did to our people. They were not so successful of stopping from declaring the validation. After 6 hours, they released my daughter. However, after the kidnapping, they keep on telling my daughter not to report the incident to the authority. So what I did, I hide my daughter, including their children.
The Subanon are suing TBI in the Philippines.
A global campaign against the negative effects of mining has developed, which calls for an end to gold mined at the expense of communities, workers, and the environment. The campaign is represented in Canada by the Ottawa-based Mining Watch Canada. Mining Watch calls for higher prices for minerals, better pay for miners, and protection for the environment. Mining Watch describes itself as a pan-Canadian initiative supported by environmental, social justice, Aboriginal, and labor organizations from across the country. Joan Koyak is National Coordinator of Mining Watch. She explains that the world price for minerals is too low because it does not reflect the true labor, environmental, and social costs of mining.
The price of metals has absolutely nothing to do with the cost to the environment and the communities around them of producing it. They deliberately keep the prices low to benefit manufacturers, actually. In places where they expropriate or remove indigenous people or traditional land users, the payouts are piddling. So you, generally speaking, the cost of metals is kept low and can remain low because nobody's paying attention to the actual cost of producing it. In the South, they can exploit workers a lot more because the government is so much more willing to do the bidding of the company and to force workers into very dangerous conditions with very low wages.
Joan describes the role of Mining Watch.
Mining Watch is a big coalition of 21 organizations with a small staff in Ottawa, and we respond to requests for communities for help. So we have on occasion been asked to provide some technical support to people in terms of battling with a mining company. So we're in a number of different countries, Indonesia, Tanzania, Mexico, Chile. When the big company comes in, it's going to take away everything, their water, their land, their livelihoods, everything. Often it's small-scale miners who are trying to resist the loss of their homes and their livelihoods because a big Canadian company's coming in. You can see that in Ghana, certainly it was the case in Tanzania. We provide an opportunity for them to get their story out to the press and to the public, and we take their stories and often bring them here to tell their stories to the Canadian government. We do have the Steelworker Humanity Fund and the CAW Social Justice Fund as members of our organization. So we work with them around some of the labor issues and the ILO standards for labor in these different mines. And we advocate with the Canadian government to take labor standards in the South seriously. They should be paid more, they should have work, they should have better conditions. If they're going to be their housing's going to be destroyed, they need to be properly compensated.
Jamie Neen is communications coordinator of Mining Watch.
When you look at the presence of Canadian mining companies in the world and the fact that they're participants in some of the worst abuses, then, you know, as Canadians we have a responsibility to deal with that. As long as these companies use Canada and use Canadian tax loopholes and Canadian stock exchanges to give them an advantage, then that's our responsibility. And you know, we're helping support them as taxpayers. Our government is supporting their activities in many countries. And, you know, we have some control over that, so let's use it.
You have been listening to Building a Just World, Fair Trade, Ethical Trade, and Canada. This is the third and final program in our series.
You can hear all three parts online. Go to www.ckln.fm and look for the link, or email news@ckln.fm for more information. I'm Asad Ismi, writer, researcher, and executive producer.
I'm Kristen Schwartz, producer.
Additional research and on-site recording by Jen Wart.
Thanks especially to Susie Alvarez for the concept of this series, to Mark Balkowski for production assistance, and to CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto. Our theme music for this series is El Mercado Equitativo by Reina Isabel Torres. It is performed by the group Recopiladores de la Pante, who are part of a cooperative of small coffee producers in Nicaragua.
Music during the break is by Lila Downs. The track is called La Linea.
This series was funded by the Canadian Union of Public Employees,
Canadian Auto Workers,
Canadian Labour Congress,
Canadian Union of Postal Workers,
Canadian Federation of Students,
Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation,
Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association,
Ontario Public Interest Research Group, University of Toronto,
Mining Watch Canada,
and Transfer Canada.
Thanks for listening.